Many, many years ago, before I ever had any involvement with the Christian Legal Society, and that was a long time ago, a friend of mine in North Carolina handed me a book by Mr. Blumeyers, who I didn't know, had never heard of. The book was published in England. It was called The Tyranny of Time. And I was very struck with that book. In fact, wrote to the publisher in England and got a whole box of them to give to some friends. And then when I was at a large book distributor in Canada, inquired about other books by this strange, mysterious person, found out a few other things he'd written. And then, lo and behold, a U.S. publisher began picking up some of his materials, and particularly the book, The Christian Mind. I believe that our speaker brings to the subject of our discussion this weekend a very crucial perspective on the importance of Christian thought on these issues, which goes beyond issues of Christian piety and Christian morality, but to the heart of how we are to think. And that is one of the predominant themes of his books, many of which, but by no means all, are on our book tables here. Formerly Dean of the College of King Alfred's College in Winchester, a graduate of Oxford, has written 20 books, some on English literature, some on Christian faith. His home is in the Keswick district near Scotland, and we're really delighted, Mr. Blumeyers, to have you share with us this weekend. After spending the weekend with us, we've arranged for him to visit a number of other Christian institutions and ministries in the United States. He's traveled here on a number of occasions before, speaking at seminaries, Southern Baptist colleges, a tour with the Christian College Coalition. So he's not a total stranger to the Christian community in the United States, but I hope that after our opportunity to hear him today, you'll begin to see why many years ago I was excited about the kind of perspective he was bringing to these issues. I want you to ignore the fact you're starting 10 minutes late. We have plenty of time, so don't worry at all about cutting short yours. We wouldn't want you to do that. So we're delighted to have you with us this morning. Just before you start, I want to make sure we're taping these, and I wonder if the people in the tape room are, would Peter or somebody over there, would you run and make sure that they know that this is for real now? We're through with all my stuff. This is the real thing. We're on to
everything.
Well, may I say how grateful I am for the invitation that brought me here to share this experience with you in this very, very lovely place. I've not been to Colorado before, and really it is overwhelming, isn't it? I hope my accent doesn't trouble you. I'm sure you know Bernard Shaw's dictum that the Americans and British are two related peoples divided only by a common language. Well, and I'm sure everyone can hear me. I don't risk saying, can you hear me at the back? Because on one occasion, a lady in the middle, obviously of charitable and unselfish disposition, put up her hand and said, I can hear you very well here, but I wouldn't mind changing places with anyone who couldn't. I must apologize, too, that in packing, I failed to include my sort of medium-distance glasses, and it's just put me under a little difficulty in that the pairs I'm wearing are largely designed for overtaking rather than for reading. Well, when Lynn Buzzard wrote to me about the subject of this conference, He lamented that the expression secular humanism is being used too glibly and vaguely. There's a tendency just to use the expression as a disapproval noise without any kind of clarity of definition. And he added, very wisely, that he thought it was important to identify the real nature of secularism as opposed to the merely secular. And this, indeed, is the crux of the matter. And I make it my starting point. Because there's a connotational gap between the two words, secular and secularism. It's a wide one. And one doesn't generally have to make that kind of jump in meaning when moving from a descriptive adjective to a corresponding abstract noun. Consider the close relationship between Christian and Christianity, or between vegetarian and vegetarianism. The relationship between secular and secularism is not comparable. It's more like the rather uncomfortable relationship between the neutral word race and the loaded word racism. When I actually checked up with the Oxford Dictionary, I found secular defined simply as of or pertaining to this world. And obviously there's nothing to alarm Christians there. Indeed, the word was once applied regularly to clergy who were running parishes as opposed to clergy who were living in monastic houses, the secular clergy, as opposed to the religious clergy. Plainly, the word has no pejorative overtones there. It opposes this worldly concerns to other worldly concerns. Certainly, secular is contrasted with religious, but only in the sense that digging a garden is one thing and praying is another thing. Secular is certainly not opposed to Christian, since presumably the Christian might dig and pray with equal regularity. Now, if you turn to the dictionary definition of secularism, this is it. The doctrine that morality should be based solely on regard to the well-being of mankind in the present life, to the exclusion of all considerations drawn from a belief in God or in a future state. And secularist, by the way, is defined as an adherent of secularism. So the two words are closely bound. So, secular is a purely neutral term, while secularism represents a view of life that challenges Christianity head on. For it excludes all considerations drawn from a belief in God or in a future state. So, the secular in itself presents no challenge to Christianity. It's the sphere of activity in which most Christians operate most of their lives. Printing a book is itself a secular activity, whether the book is a comic magazine or the Bible. Our Lord was a carpenter, and carpentry is in itself a secular activity, whether the artifact manufactured be a dining room table or a pulpit. Of course, the one is later put to a secular and the other to a religious use. So, engaging in secular activities certainly does not make anyone a secularist, an exponent of secularism. Just as eating a meal of cheese and salad won't make you a vegetarian. Indeed, living on eggs and cheese and salad for a year won't make you, in the usual sense, a vegetarian, unless you hold the view that the exclusion of meat from diet is a matter of principle. Vegetarianism excludes meat as a matter of principle, and secularism excludes God and the religious dimension as a matter of principle. So, the distinction between Christianity and secularism is such that the two must always collide, while the distinction between religious and secular is like the distinction between the right hand and the left. Involvement in secular activities no more commits you to secularism than involvement in human activities commits you to humanism. Our linguistic usages are odd in this respect, perhaps. You only need to commit one murder to be a murderer. Yet no accumulation of human activities will necessarily turn you into a humanist. You only need to tell one lie to become a liar, but telling the truth one day will not turn you into an honest man. I'm trying, by a few examples, to clear the verbal air, in particular, to put the word secularism in the company in which it belongs. After all, it defines a kind of faith, and a rather restrictive one, as we shall see, if we put it alongside words that work comparably. The ordinary meat-eater can't be accused of inconsistency if he's caught one day eating a salad, but the vegetarian loses his right to the label if he's caught eating a steak. Drinking a glass of Coke won't make you a teetotaler, but drinking a single glass of beer will finish you off as a teetotaler. Saying one prayer may not make you a Christian, but it will finish you off as a bona fide secularist. This is the important point. The Christian indulges in secular activities year after year without thus necessarily compromising his commitment to Christianity. But a man cannot say a single prayer without compromising his commitment to secularism. In short, like teetotalism and vegetarianism, secularism is a noun whose connotation involves a crucial exclusion. And you can define the secularist position only in negatives. There's no life except this life in time. There's no order of being except this which we explore with our senses and our instruments. There's no condition of well-being except that of healthy, comfortable life in time. There's no God to be worshipped, for no God created us. There's no God to be propitiated, for there is no God to offend. There is no reward to be sought, no punishment to be avoided, except those which derive from earthly authority. There's no law to be obeyed, except those which earthly authority imposes or earthly prudence recommends. Such are the tenets of secularism. No Christian thinks it possible to live without secular activities. No Christian wants to abolish them. But secularism, by definition, excludes Christian faith and practice. We Christians are not trying to prohibit any activity on the grounds that it is secular. While secularists are committed to prohibit every activity that is religious. Christianity wants to claim the secular. Secularism wants to abolish Christianity. So who are the excluders, the narrow prohibitionists? We Christians, who do not dispute the validity of secular activities and secular motives, but who say we want something else as well, or secularists who dispute the validity of all religious activity and motivation? Who are the excluders, the bearers of fetters, the shutters off of avenues, the closers of minds? We've had too much woolly thinking on this issue. We've had too much talk about the Christian attitude to secularism, and not enough about the secularist attitude to Christianity. Exponents of secularism talk as though Christian teaching closes off options, while their teaching opens doors. And the very reverse is true. They talk as though Christianity is restrictive while secularism is open-minded. It is nonsense. Secularism is, by definition, so closed-minded that it is trying to shut off from the minds of contemporary men and women the faith, the hope, and the vision that stabilized and enriched the lives of the generations who built our civilization and gave us our culture. Secularism is an attempt to fetter, to limit, to prohibit. It is, in fact, a new form of slavery. In looking up the word secular, by the way, in the dictionary, I found a quotation from Gladstone. "I do not believe that secular motives are adequate either to propel or to restrain the children of our race." Clearly, he was speaking primarily about education. But he summed up the Christian attitude to the secular neatly. It is inadequate. Secular activities and motives in themselves are inadequate to man's needs, inadequate to satisfy his soul. Inadequate. The Christian, it seems, wants more of something. The secularist wants less. The Christian says the secular is inadequate. The secularist says the religious is inadmissible. And the notion of inadequacy is worth examining. When we say that things secular are inadequate to satisfy human need or answer human aspiration, what do we mean? For there's more than one kind of inadequacy. You might say to your son, those shoes are fine for driving in or for strolling about the city streets, but they'll be quite inadequate if you want to climb a mountain. You'll need something stronger and tougher. Or you might say to someone who is ambitiously planning an endurance test of walking across the United States, those boots won't get you very far. You'll need half a dozen pairs like that to complete the trek. Stronger boots, more pairs of boots. Better versions of the same thing, more and more of the same thing. That's what one kind of inadequacy calls for. But suppose your pedestrian, having walked across the United States, wants now to go to Europe and is bursting to be off. You'll have to tell him that 100 pairs of boots and the strongest boots in the world won't be any good at all for crossing the Atlantic. He'll either have to fly by plane or sail by boat. Footwear, however strong, is useless, and that's another kind of inadequacy. Not inadequacy of degree, but inadequacy of kind. Total inadequacy in kind, of the means to the requirement, such that something utterly different is called for. Now, I'm afraid that when some of our secularist opponents hear us talking about the inadequacy of purely secular motives, they think we are talking about the first kind of inadequacy, inadequacy of degree, when in fact we are talking about the second, inadequacy of kind. Their minds are so attuned to secularist thinking that they imagine we want to supplement the kind of motivation that they recognize with something rather stronger and bigger, but roughly of the same kind. They think we want to recommend stronger boots and more pairs of boots when we're telling them they'll have to learn to fly or swim. For the activity, the thought processes they need to be involved in are quite out of the range of those they are accustomed to. For, as we Christians see it, limitedly secular motivation towards keeping fit, making money, living comfortably, enjoying food, drink, sex, entertainment, travel, family life, and sociability, consists in pursuing a sense of well-being appropriate for intelligent animals but not for God's children. And even such well-being is becoming more and more elusive as the old religious sanctions that disciplined it are forgotten or scrapped. As the human failures to achieve a tolerable sense of intelligent animal well-being becomes self-evidently more numerous, secularist mentors provide roundabout recipes for boosting self-confidence, for sharpening the responsiveness of the human antennae to what brings earthly satisfaction and pleasure, or for numbing the inner disquiet of the spirit. Tougher and bigger and better pairs of boots. What secularist mentors will not accept is that man is a creature of a different order, that he has dimensions of being which they fail to allow for. Footwear can never answer all the needs of men and women who, by creation and vocation, are designed to soar high above the earth. Secularism, then, can be defined only as a series of exclusions. God, religion, and so on. And a series of exclusions scarcely constitutes a philosophy. And this is one reason why the debate between Christianity and secularism is a confused one. Too often, the meat-eaters are arguing with the vegetarians as though the virtues of lettuce or cheese were at issue. Too often, the vegetarians are talking to the meat-eaters as though steaks only existed in fairy tales. We need to make clear that insofar as secularism is a thought-out position, as opposed to an attitude adopted unthinkingly, it is based on the philosophy of naturalism. Naturalism is the creed implicit and sometimes explicit in present-day secularism. Naturalism, the belief that the only reality is to be found within this universe governed by those laws of nature which our scientists explore. Christianity, on the other hand, is a religion rooted in the supernatural, in that which is superior to the natural order, that in which the natural order was grounded, that within which the natural order subsists. That, of course, is only an abstract philosophical way of saying that the Christian sees human life and human history held in the hands of God. He sees the whole universe sustained by God's power and love. He sees this life in time as an inconclusive experience preparing us for another. This world as a temporary place of refuge, not our true and final home. And here lies the basic philosophical cleavage between the Christian mind and the popular assumptions behind so much contemporary thought and action. Naturalism treats this temporal universe of ours as the whole show, the only sure basis of knowledge, the only reliable source of meaning and value. This is the tacit creed of contemporary secularism. This is the unexamined presupposition at large in the very air we breathe as thinking beings. And the average citizen nowadays is a victim of daily, hourly brainwashing by the media, by the press, the radio, television, the adverts, and so much else in our cultural environment that is hammering into his head the notion that this life in time is the only thing that matters, that all questions of meaning, value, purpose, good, evil, are exclusively a matter of a 70-year lifespan on this planet. You don't have to keep saying this explicitly in order to convey it. All you have to do is to provide a ceaseless flood of entertainment, news, discussion, comment, which bypasses all questions of spiritual reality and ignores even the possibility of supernatural life. There are exceptions, of course, but by and large, our media do not present, either in the form of drama or observation or discussion, a commentary upon life which takes the Christian God and the life hereafter seriously into account. So, the basic collision is between a naturalistic philosophy and a religion rooted in the supernatural. It is the exclusive, blinkered rootedness of the secularist mind in the untranscended things of earth that provokes the violent clash with the Christian mind. And this is true at all levels of thought and action, from the scholarly level at which Orthodox theologians collide with diluters and enemies of the faith, to the popular level at which the glossy magazine version of life closes the mind to the Christian account of the human situation. The collision is indeed a violent one. On the one hand, is the assumption that all is over when you die, that after 60 or 70 years, sheltered and cushioned by the modern technologized society, with wall-to-wall welfare protection against suffering and unease, you can sign off for good. That eating, sleeping, breathing, and the rest constitute the total sum of things. That in worldly prosperity and well-being, in the years between vaccination and cremation, lies the only source of all value and meaning. On the other hand, there is the belief that our life in time is a brief and transitory passage to eternity, and that our task en route is to bring our fellow beings into the company and keeping of the God who made them, visited them, and died for them. The belief that men and women will be called to account for the part they have played in a world caught up in cosmic conflict between the powers of darkness and the powers of light. Well, there can surely be no honest compromise of final motivation between those who believe that the finite system we inhabit from cradle to grave is the total sum of things, and those who hold that we are pilgrims of eternity, making a brief journey through time, and that everything in this life that deeply matters points elsewhere. For the secularist, death is the end, and this world is opaque. For the Christian, death is the beginning, and this world is open to the eternal. And the more thoughtful the Christian is, the more sensitive he will be to the almost crushing pressure of the spiritual war that is tearing at the heart of the universe and pushing its way into the day-to-day choices and decisions of every living soul. For if the gospel means what it says, life is a matter of salvation or damnation. It is a matter of living in a fallen world, but a redeemed world, of inheriting a fallen nature, but a divinely redeemed nature, of being thrust thus into the cosmic drama of conflict between the powers of good and evil. The more you explore the issue, the wider the gulf yawns between Christian and secularist presuppositions. The Christian sees the whole of human life and human history enacted under God. That is what the Bible is all about, and that is the framework within which the Christian makes his estimate of all purpose and meaning, down to the merest detail of act and thought. This life in nature, of the senses and the brain, is not the total sum of things. Overriding the vast machinery of cosmic change stretches out the unchanging order of things supernatural, where there is no need of sun or moon. For the glory of the Lord is all in all. Such is the collision between the secularist assumptions widespread in our environment and the gospel of Christ. We recognize it when it is pointed out to us. How deeply do we personally assimilate it? There's a poem by Yeats which begins, "God guard us from those thoughts men think in the mind alone. He that sings a lasting song thinks in the marrow bone." Indeed, God guard us from those thoughts men think in the mind alone, that never touch the marrow bone, never touch the nerves of feeling and conviction, and are never translated into action. It is fearsome, positively fearsome, for the Christian today to reflect on the yawning gap that separates his mindset from the modish assumptions of his contemporaries. For those assumptions, as I said, are the assumptions of naturalism. And naturalism has its own criteria, its own vocabulary, and they are not the criteria, and they are not the vocabulary of Christianity. For instance, in current secularist usage, words like aim, purpose, cause, result, good, evil, have to do with events that take place exclusively within history. While the Christian can scarcely speak seriously of purpose at all, let alone of good or evil, without introducing a supernatural dimension, such concepts, Christianly used, outreach all finite objectives. For all human purpose is related to divine purpose, or to diabolical purpose. There is no Christian statement about any fundamental issue of meaning or purpose that can be adequately articulated without explicit or implicit reference to a state of being beyond time, a state of being which secularism on principle ignores. For in the last resort, the will of God is the only ground basis of action we know, the grace of God the only energizing impetus we know, the service of God the only ultimate end we know. How can we come to terms with those whose criteria and values disregard such essentials, and indeed whose notional and verbal equipment is specifically devised to contain the facts of human destiny and the meaning of life within the framework of time-locked naturalism? Well, this is what we are up against. the control of the secular sphere is increasingly in the hands of secularists. And the secular is far too precious, far too important to be left in the hands of secularists. Secularists are the last people to be put in control of things secular. It is like putting the control of the world's money into the hands of misers. It is indeed a bit like putting paedophiles or pederasts in charge of a nursery school. For the secular is that sphere of things which ought to be used by God's children in the service and love of God and each other. The secular is that sphere of things which ought to be enjoyed and used to the ultimate end of serving God and man. Secularists believe that the secular is to be enjoyed for its own sake, as misers believe that money is to be gloated over for its own sake. And when we consider what we have inherited in the way of secular civilization and culture from ancestors who were so often God-fearing men and women who set their hearts on things above, our educational system, our culture, our literature, our buildings, and then we ponder into whose hands we have increasingly consigned the keeping of our inheritance, and the responsibility of transmitting it to later generations, can we really feel other than deeply worried? In education and in the media, for instance, we have today at our disposal the most potent mind-molding instruments ever devised by man. Can we pretend that these instruments are in the right hands? Can we pretend that they are used by and large for the service of God and the nourishment of his children in that service? Can we pretend that they are used by and large to recommend a life of virtue and self-discipline? Consider what eccentric and amoral ideas of human self-expression are widely canvassed and practiced among our secularist intelligentsia. Then ask yourself, what is being urged upon the young today in our educational institutions as a pattern of the good life and as a recipe for happiness? And what models of satisfaction and self-fulfillment are set before us as we assimilate what is presented to us by the media and the advertisers? The presentation of information about goods, events, or personalities cannot be insulated from qualifying undercurrents of approval or depreciation. Correspondingly, the reflection of contemporary life in entertainment and documentation cannot be insulated from evaluative overtones that recommend or denigrate. Thus, an image of the good life is conveyed to us by advertisers and the media, and according to the measure of our moral spiritual resources, we accept it or reject it. And the weaker among us succumb to allurements towards self-indulgence and to illusory dreams of self-aggrandizement. The weakest of all limp into bemused states of mingled aggression and lust, envy and discontent, protest and insanity. The values and propaganda of the less responsible media men and advertisers fuel the lust for sharing at any cost in the indulgences apparently recognized as essential to the good life by the cheap jacks of the publicity game. Meanwhile, through entertainment by story, drama, lecture, discussion, habits of thought and behavior are inculcated, which regard life as a sensual free-for-all, from which moral imperatives have been shot away and spiritual reality banished. Well, I shall have more to say about that in my next lecture. For the moment, I ask, what is the lesson of all this? That Christians must shun the secular world? Quite the contrary. The moral is that the secular sphere must be rescued from the secularists. The pressing Christian vocation of today is to wrench the secular sphere from the grip of secularists. You must have sensed all this or you wouldn't be gathering together as a professional association determined to bring Christian thinking to bear upon your secular work. And so far as the desperate struggle between Christianity and secularism is concerned, a twofold response is required of Christians today. In the first place, the Christian church itself must be defended against the infiltration of secularist thinking, which would corrupt the purity of the gospel message. In the second place, Christians of all professions and trades, and especially of those professions which are intimately connected with the problems and vicissitudes of human life, must carry into the secular sphere the faith and vision which alone can rescue the secular sphere from the secularist. Thank you.